Does the long saga of the Catholic clergy abuse scandal have deep roots in Ireland? It's a provocative question that Irish Times journalist Patsy McGarry has been discussing lately here in the United States. We heard him speak about it at Boston College recently. The clergy abuse scandal in Ireland erupted in 2009, 7 years after the U.S. Catholic Church was rocked by sex abuse scandals from Boston to L.A. In Ireland, though, the government published two very damning reports outlining rampant abuse by the church and a systemic cover-up of that abuse. These were called the Murphy and the Ryan reports. So I asked Patsy McGarry whether what happened in Ireland is different than the clergy abuse scandals in other countries, whether it's worse.
It's too early to say whether it's worse in Ireland, but there are some very disquieting factors about what has come out over the last 20 years in Ireland, of course, in the United States, in Canada, in Australia, in New Zealand, in the United Kingdom, where there are so many Irish names among clerical child sex abusers. Now, you could argue that as Ireland was the Catholic country of the English-speaking world, that it shouldn't be too surprising that you find so many Irish names among Catholic priests who have abused in the English-speaking world. But looking at your own country, for instance, there are far less Italian and Spanish names among abusers, at least so far. It's too early to call it, I really believe, where European countries are concerned, South American countries are concerned, and probably where Africa is concerned, because I think they are at a much earlier stage than we are or than you are in the United States. It's just beginning to be exposed in those countries, and I expect the pattern will be similar in those countries to what it has been here in the US, what it has been in Ireland, where every time there are revelations, more and more people come forward with further allegations, either against the priest being talked about at that time or other priests. It tends to grow exponentially. But I am, I suppose, like a lot of Irish people, very much aware of the huge Irish element to this story. And I think that there may be a uniquely Irish character to it, probably rooted in our own history. And I, as you know, talked about this in Boston College.
So well, what does that mean? What does that uniquely Irish? Why? And when you say that, have you looked at lists of accused priests and said there are an awful lot of Irish names on
yes,
this list?
Yes, yeah. I have written about this. I have listed off the names of abused priests. I've done this going back 10 years. In fact, I did it first for a highly respected English magazine called The Tablet. They asked me to write about abuse. The title of my piece was Clerical Child Sex Abuse, an Irish Disease? And they said they couldn't publish the article, even though they commissioned it, because they'd spent decades trying to free themselves from a perception in England that they were an anti-Irish magazine. So I published it in our own newspaper, and I thought myself, and that was not my intention, but I thought the sky would fall, so to speak, that the usual suspects would be on my back, but they weren't, because basically the facts are so glaring. The numbers of Irish names they just jump out at you all the time. So it made me look as to why this may be the case. In Ireland, up to the famine of 1845 to 1847-8, before that period, we had the greatest population we've ever had in Ireland, over 8 million people. Predominantly poor, predominantly Catholic, repressed and persecuted Catholics. Catholicism was technically illegal. You had large families and people married young. The potato was a very fertile crop. So what they did was, when a young couple got married, the parents subdivided the land and gave them a plot. And so they could have plenty of food and also plenty of children, clearly. But after the famine, all of that changed. The population of the part of Ireland we now know as the Republic halved between 1845 and 1961. And most of those people after the famine, some 2 million, well, approximately 1 million died, 1 million emigrated immediately after the famine. The whole nature of land holding in Ireland changed dramatically. There was no more subdivision of land when a young couple got married. Whatever the holding size was, it went to one son only. The rest of the family had to emigrate, and frequently some of the others, anyway, boys and girls, were encouraged to enter the church. This was linked in to a very repressive Victorian prudery, which really took hold in the United Kingdom and indeed in Ireland towards the latter part of the 19th century. And coincident with that was a theology called Jansenism, which had been introduced into Irish seminaries in the late 18th century. It was a theology which really hated the body, saw the body as a threat, a temptation to our salvation, and tended to be very repressive where issues of sexuality were concerned. So all of these, I believe, combined to create a particular culture which allowed for this perversion to find its way In Ireland itself, and indeed through the Irish diaspora abroad, I mean, the number of marriages in Ireland throughout the middle decades of the last century plummeted to approximately a third of what they were when the new state was set up by 1961, again, when the population of the Republic was at its lowest ever. Meanwhile, the seminaries were packed. We had so many young men in the priesthood that between a half and a third had to go on the missions. There was nothing for them to do in Ireland. And the Catholic Church itself seemed to be obsessed throughout all those decades of the 20th century up to 1970s anyhow, with sex as really the only sin. They railed and railed and railed against it. And marriage was at a very late stage in life. The son who inherited the farm frequently didn't get married till his parents died. So there's this shocking repression on issues of sexuality. And so it isn't hugely surprising that those guys who did enter the priesthood, I suppose, and particularly those who entered the Christian Brothers, because they did so at the age of 12 and 13, and then thereafter reared in an all-male environment.
And those are the religious orders.
Absolutely. Mm. And they then went into all-boys institutions with a very immature sexuality themselves. And so the abuse we now know went on. So I think all of these factors came together to create a very peculiarly Irish twist on this shocking tragedy. A combination of history, theology, and economics has meant that Ireland has suffered to a greater degree from this abuse issue than most other Catholic countries.
Even though there may have been history and theology and economics on your side here to put together a bunch of conditions that might affect, say, Irish male sexuality, how does that then become pedophilia, really? Because it seems like a bit of a jump.
Sex with a boy did not entail the same risk as sex with a girl. There's no risk of a boy becoming pregnant, for a start. There was also, at the time, because of the innocence of culture at large, nobody thought there was anything suspicious about a priest hanging around with a boy or a young man. Yeah. It didn't raise the same suspicions that could have the common interest of sport, which is a huge thing in Ireland, or whatever. There were never any questions about it. Again, where the genuine paedophile was concerned, it was a glorious opportunity. I mean, we know now from court cases and cases investigated by those tribunals that these guys were quite cavalier. They'd go into classrooms and take out kids and nobody would ask a question. Nobody assumed there was anything untoward going on. The status of the priest was such in Ireland that nobody would attribute anything sexual to a priest whatsoever, that it wouldn't even cross the mind of the ordinary Irish Catholic. So it was a paradise for paedophiles. There's not about it. I'm not saying that these guys went into religion with that intent. At the age of 12 or 13, as in Christian Brothers' cases, or 17 or 18 when they were young men entering the priesthood, it's doubtful if their sexuality was so developed that they'd have any consciousness of themselves as paedophiles. But certainly when that emerged later, it was free for all for them.
Patsy McGarry, religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times. He's been here in the U.S. talking about the Catholic clergy sex abuse scandal and the Murphy and Ryan reports from the Irish government that documented decades of abuse in that country and the church's cover-up of it. When he was here, I asked McGarry how the scandal has affected Catholics in Ireland.
I don't think you could underestimate the impact of this abuse scandal on the Irish people. I mean, Irish people, especially older Irish people, were very devoutly Catholic. I'm almost reluctant to use that word were, because I think most of them remain devoutly Catholic. But psychologically what they have done is they've separated out their belief in their faith from their belief in the institution. As with so many other institutions in Ireland today, the Irish people have very little confidence in the institutional Catholic Church. We've been let down by our politicians, by our bankers, by our police, and by our church. I mean, the pillars upon which most of our older generation would have built their lives have fallen one by one. I mean, one man, when Murphy came out, said to his parish priest, and to the parish priest that told me this, he says, "You've lost our young people." Archbishop Ewan Martin, in fact, talked about the loss of young people when he came back to Dublin. He said one of the most things that surprised him was the absence of young people between the ages of 16 and 34 from all church services, and that remains the case in Dublin. Young people are not engaging, not just with the Catholic Church, they're not engaging with religion. This man, this old man, said, with the Ryan report, he said, "You lost my children," his middle-aged children. And he said, "With Murphy, you're now losing my generation." Mm. But he was talking about the church's institution rather than the faith. But it's been very difficult for older, true, devout, loyal Irish Catholics. And really, what has compounded that is that the people who were abused came from two types of families. And this you find everywhere, including here in the United States. They came from very dysfunctional families, or the most devout families, where the priest was so trusted that he was allowed ready access to the children, took them into bed, whatever, all of that, and there was never a question about it. So for those devout parents whose children were abused, there's a shocking sense of guilt, because they didn't protect their children. They feel they gave ready access without question to that priest. Mm. I mean, and that sense of betrayal never leaves those people.
The Vatican has appointed Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley to help investigate some of this. An apostolic visitation, I believe, is what it's referred to. How is that being received in Ireland? Is that people optimistic about that?
Well, Cardinal O'Malley has visited Dublin twice as part of his apostolic visitation there. I met him briefly on two occasions. He came across as a very pastoral sort of man. He's met about 250 people in Dublin so far, many of them abuse victims. Those I've spoken to are very positive. They say he listened very compassionately, at great length. He's a very good listener. For me, the most impressive event he participated in was a liturgy of repentance in Dublin. He and Archbishop Martin conducted it based on the Good Friday service. The wording and the text was prepared by abuse victims themselves, from quite across the range, from people who are abused in institutions to people who are abused by priests. Both men washed the feet of eight people, but what was most powerful was the text and the honesty with which it was articulated by the two senior churchmen themselves, what they had to say themselves, and that their insistence that excerpts from the Ryan and Murphy reports were included as part of the service, and they were probably the most damning parts of the Ryan and Murphy report where the church was concerned. And I've been to many of these services, but I can say it was the first one I felt was authentic.
Are you Catholic?
I'm culturally Catholic. I was reared within the Catholic tradition. In my small town in the west of Ireland, there was one Protestant family. All others were Catholic. I attended the De La Salle brothers. I attended St. Nathie's College, which is a diocesan college where all the teachers were priests except two. So I was immersed in Catholicism for most of my formative years. I stopped practicing not because of Catholicism, but I suppose I used to think I'd be a priest myself till my late teens, early 20s. And what stopped me was the vow of obedience. And I think I had great insight as a young fella. I was not prepared to sacrifice conscience. Celibacy wasn't really an issue then. I didn't know much about sex at that age either. And latterly, then, it evolved from there into an issue over divinity itself.
Explain divinity to folks who don't know.
God. The existence of God.
Okay. So you just can't believe in the existence
I can't,
of God. But you'll still go to Mass.
Put it this way. I haven't the faith to believe, and I haven't the faith to be an atheist. And I do believe it requires as much faith to be an atheist, to say there isn't God. Mm-hmm. Especially for somebody who comes from a culture like I did, where God was all pervasive, and we were taught to believe God as a given, and as a fundamental. I really have no confidence, no faith at all in fundamentalist atheists any more than I do in fundamentalist Christians. I think such fundamentalism is just primitive and lacks all nuance and truth.
Is it tough then for journalists in Ireland? I mean, we get an awful lot of journalism from yourself and others about this issue. Is it difficult for journalists to cover this as Catholics?
It is, of course, extraordinarily difficult to deal with this issue. Coming from a Catholic background, I know a lot of men in the priesthood. I respect hugely a lot of men in the priesthood, those who taught me, those who I know today. I know them to be absolutely good men through and through, and they're going through hell on earth because of this issue, because they're being branded very unfairly and grossly unfairly. Some have even been accused falsely, which has to be the most shocking experience, I think, known to anybody, any priest today, right, or anywhere, any man, to be accused of this issue, because you never fully escape it, even if you're cleared. There's always those who will jump on the suspicion. As an Irishman, it is also extremely difficult to talk about the possibility, the probability or whatever, of it being a peculiarly Irish experience, or that we have made a peculiar contribution to this shocking tragedy, is a very painful thing to take on board as an Irishman. But I think it's true. And we have to be honest about it. And we have to look at why that happened, so that we can ensure it never happens again. We have to look at the Irish attitude to sexuality as taught to us by what I think was a deeply pessimistic philosophy. I don't think our young people have that problem, which is good. But so that's one of the good aspects of it, is that our young people in Ireland don't suffer these repressions.
Patsy McGarry is religious affairs correspondent for the Irish Times.